there was a perverted echo of Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15 is speaking about a redemptive post-fall development. The mythology puts all of this back as part of the original creation. They see evil as something eternal there. But the idea of the two outstanding representatives of the forces of good and evil is on target. That's what we have here. It's a duel of champion. It's the David Goliath type of thing, a trial by ordeal that will take place, where the fate of the armies is settled by this one individual combat, where God will do the decisive thing to vindicate his person over against the enemy. And when that climactic battle takes place, he, that individual seed of the woman, will deliver the fatal blow to you. Yes, you will deliver a blow to him, but it will be to the heel. His blow to you will be to the head. Now, since verse 15 is an exposition of verse 14, and verse 14 has stated plainly that the ultimate complete subjugation, the perpetual doom of the serpent, verse 15, in describing the details of the battle, must end the same way, with the complete defeat of Satan. And so what the church has normally recognized here as a contrast between head and heel, heel a wound but not the ultimate, head a fatal and ultimate wound. I think this is on the right track. And of course, what it also does is to bring out the two aspects of the messianic career. When this messianic seed of the woman appears, it will be to suffer that afterwards he might enter into his glory. He must have experienced the bruising of the heel, that he might crush the serpent's head. And the very image involves both things. If you just picture the human person stamping with his heel upon the head of the serpent, it's in that very process that he both suffers the bruising of his heel and crushes the serpent. And so these two dimensions of Messiah's ministry, the suffering and the glory, are present right from the beginning. And how it works out that the suffering is consistent with the glory, we gradually discover. And by the time we come to Isaiah and the suffering servant of the Lord, it turns out that it is by virtue of the very fact of his suffering that he wins the victory. Christ wins the victory by his suffering on the cross. By his suffering on the cross, he defeats Satan as the accuser of the brethren. Satan can no longer accuse the brethren because on the cross, in his suffering, Christ has paid the atoning price for them. And so it is precisely through sufferings that he attains the victory. It is because of his humbling himself unto death that therefore God has highly exalted him, Philippians 2, and given him a name which is above every name. So all of that great mystery of Christ's humiliation and exaltation is, as I said, briefly, cryptically, but nevertheless, it's there, is it not? Right from this mother promise, this Protevangelium, as it's called, of Genesis 3:15. So you get this image now of the seed of the woman, which was both corporate and also individual. And the individual who tramples Satan underfoot and is in even that figure, that Satan trampling idea is in Romans 16:20 applied to us. And when Paul promises the Christian church that God will soon be trampling Satan under our feet. And so somehow this is part of that, where what Christ does, we share in it. Even this victory over Satan is thus attributed to the people whom Christ, second Adam, represents. But there is the basic picture of that history. And so it is primarily a word of curse against Satan, that ultimately he's going to be defeated. And of course, the victory of Christ takes place decisively at his first coming, but completely and finally at his second coming is where the ultimate final judgment of Satan takes place. Now, as I said, if you had any, you know, that there are still people, even ones you'd expect to have more common sense than this, and I forget just which particular reform person I was. I have someone in mind, I won't mention the name. Don't take this in the classic way. You hear a lot of critical scholarship saying that this is just one of those stories about the origins of things, one of those etiological little accounts that tell you the beginnings of this kind of custom or that. And so people hate snakes. And so here's a little story about why people, how it began that people hate snakes. You know, what a lot of nonsense. This is not about how people came to hate snakes. This has to do with God and Satan and ultimate things. And that's the way the Bible interprets it in Revelation 12. Now, just quickly, you flip over to Revelation 12. And the same three principles that you had in Genesis 3, Satan, the woman, and the seed of the woman, appear here in Revelation 12. And in the case of the seed of the woman, you have both the individual and the corporate aspects of it as well. And, you know, you're familiar with the passage, and right from the outset, there is the enmity going on, and there is the woman now, one of the three principles, and she is pregnant and about to bring forth the man-child, and there is the second principle, Satan, the old dragon, crouching before her, ready to devour the man-child. There is hot enmity between the two being expressed, and ready to devour the man-child when he's born. And the child is born, and of course, as the chapter goes on, it's perfectly clear that this is the messianic child, because you have messianic prophecies from the Psalms and so on describe the actual conflict of the man-child, the son of man, the seed of the woman. All of those are appropriate titles for this man-child, this son born to the woman. His conflict with Satan is not directly described. That there's hostility, that there was going to be a conflict is clear enough, but the outcome is described. The man-child is caught up to the heavenly throne. And he is the one who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter, you see. That's messianic prophecy. Her child was snatched up to God and to his throne, and the woman led the dragon. So the woman then fled into the desert and so on. So there, the story is told twice. The imagery of the man-child's victory over Satan is first told in terms of this imagery of the incarnation, the son of man, the man-child, the seed of the woman. And then the story is told in terms of upper register heavenly reality, where Satan exists with all of his angels in that realm beyond our observing up there. And Christ is there too. And especially then in his ascended glory. And now we get a picture of the battle of Christ against Satan in terms, and here's a disputed point, in terms, I would say, of Christ, not in his incarnational manifestation, but in his capacity as the angel of the Lord. Now, all through the Old Testament before his incarnation, you know, he appears as the Malach Yahweh, the angel of the Lord. And that's a messianic appearance of Christ before his resurrection. And the book of Revelation includes all kinds of imagery, including Old Testament images of things. And so here it uses especially this Old Testament imagery of Christ as the angel of the Lord. And the specific proper name of this angel expressing his nature is who is like God. This is a divine being, this one. And incidentally, the satanic beast, there's so much counterfeiting in the book of Revelation of the things of God are counterfeited. And so the beast has the counterfeit name, who is like the beast. Huh? But the Messiah's name is who is like God, Michael. Who is like God, Michael, Michael. Michael is Messiah, and Michael, and you know, when Jesus was on earth, he said, "Now look, if I wanted, I could call upon 12 legions of angels, and they would come and fight and deliver me from the cross. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." So he doesn't call upon the 12 legions of angels to deliver him from his sufferings. But now that he has suffered and he's ascended into heaven, now we see Christ with his 12 legions of angels fighting against Satan and his angels, and of course he wins the victory. So the story of the victory is told twice, and the result in both cases is that Satan loses and he's cast out of heaven. And the book of Revelation tells it further. He's bound for 1,000 years on earth until at last he's loosed for a little season, and then he is destroyed forever. But here's the beginning of his disastrous overthrow, and he's cast out of heaven as a result of Christ's victory and his exaltation. Satan's cast out of heaven. And so all the elements you see of Genesis 3:15 are there, the same parties, the woman, Satan, the seed of the woman, and then the 12th chapter concludes by, here's Satan on earth. He can't get directly at that man-child, that Christ figure at the right hand of the Father up there, but he can get at you and me down here on earth. He can get at the woman. He can get at the church. And so the story goes on now. At the end of that 12th chapter, they say that then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring. Isn't that neat? Genesis 3 had the seed of the woman, the offspring of the woman, both the individual one, the Messiah, and the corporate company, like Romans 16:20, where Paul applies it to all of us. And Revelation 12 has the same dual view of it. There was the individual man-child caught up to heaven, but now down on earth there's the rest of the woman, the church, the saints of God, and they are here sort of vulnerable. Satan can get at us, which he proceeds to do, and so the rest of the book of Revelation tells how he is getting at us through his agents, the beast and the false prophet and so forth. But there's an inspired interpretation, if you please, in Revelation 12 of Genesis 3:15. And as I say, you should have no hesitation in accepting the classic ecclesiastical tradition as the proper exegesis. This is this programmatic prophecy right at the beginning of our redemptive history, giving in broad outline the whole story of the rest of human history of redemptive history. Well, but it was, at this point, its purpose was a word of judgment upon Satan. But now Adam and Eve have sinned, mankind has sinned in them, and now even though this history is going to go on after the fall, but it's going to have a different character, obviously. You know, we already have learned that they are no longer a place within the holy realm. They are thrown out of the holy, and so the whole world is now the non-holy realm. It's a completely context for human existence from this point until the consummation. And things aren't going to be all wonderful the way they were back in the Garden of Eden, where God gave his angels charge over them so that they should not dash their foot against the stone. Now, there's not only going to be stones out there in the world, but there's not going to be the providential care over the foot. Now they are going to be breaking their toes on the stones, and all kinds of other things that would not have affected them adversely will now victimize them through their history. And so there's going to be a curse. There was the ultimate curse of final damnation is pronounced on Satan. Now here, there is a curse that's pronounced on mankind in Adam and Eve, and it does not yet take the form of hell. That will be the ultimate curse down there. But meanwhile, there is a common curse, a limited curse. It's not a blessing, it's a curse, but it is not all-out hell. It has all kinds of adverse effects, but it is not the ultimate curse. It's a common curse, and it has, as its correlative, a common blessing, or grace. It's the common woe, and it's the common weal. these opposites, whatever terminology you want, if you don't like the idea of common grace, some other term, that's bringing out the fact that here is something then that's going to be the common experience of believers and all of the seed of the woman and all of the seed of the serpent coexisting together in this world are going to experience this common curse. The seed of the serpent will also experience the ultimate curse along with the devil himself of hell. But even the seed of the woman within this history are going to experience, along with unbelievers, the common curse. And verses 16 through 19 proceed to spell out the general shape of human existence in terms of this common curse. Now, we'll look at it from that point of view first, and then come back and look at it from the point of view of how, at the same time, this implicit in here is the theme of common blessing. Not the blessings of heaven, but nevertheless, the blessings in the sense that there is a limitation put on the curse. And that's how these two things are correlative. That the blessings of common grace are putting the reins on the curse so that it doesn't run away wild. It's a limitation on them. So these two ideas balance each other out. Well, what are the features then of the common curse? Verses 16 through 19 here in Genesis 3. And there's the general thought that death, physical death. Now, we were talking before, the death that they were threatened with at the beginning was hell itself. Now there's a place for physical death. And that's going to be the ultimate form of the common curse. That is the final shape that the common curse takes in human experience is this thought of physical death. Now that's the actually comes at the end of it. I might have begun the other way around, but I began with the ultimate expression of the common curse, which is death, whether for the man or the woman. Then in addition to this common experience of death, which both men and women experience, the text brings out the form that the common curse will take in the peculiar experience of the woman and the peculiar experience of the man. But in the case of both of them, the ultimate outcome of this whole new process is going to be by the sweat of your brow you will eat food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. So that's the final expression of the common curse. Now, it's necessary to get straight what's going on here. It says, for dust you are, and to the dust you will return. Is it saying that it is inevitable because you are made from the dust, because you have this physical component in your constituency? Is it inevitable, therefore, that you had to die? You were made from the dust, and so you naturally, no matter what. No, the wages of sin is death. Huh? And it wasn't inevitable because of the way in which God made man of the earth earthy that he had to die. What it is saying is this, that since, because of your sin, you are now subject to God's curse and wrath, that curse and wrath of God can take the form of physical death because, as a matter of fact, you were made from the dust. Therefore, you can return to the dust. So it is not an explanation of why they must die, but it's an explanation of how it is that they can experience God's judgment in the form of physical death. But the death itself is due to their sin. So that's the ultimate form of this. And this death, of course, casts its shadow over everything leading up to it. So that as the fallen mankind individually, we live out our existence. It's under the shadow of the inevitability of death, which then, you know, you think about it and it seems to make everything else meaningless. Hmm? And the kind of thought that might emerge in Ecclesiastes, apart from the redemptive eschatological hope that we have, that otherwise everything would seem to be vanity of vanities, because the death makes the whole thing vanity and in vain. You can't take it with you. What's the use of bothering? That's now, of course, that's we don't live apart from the redemptive, and so the what Christ has done and the hope of resurrection puts back meaning into our life, even though we face the inevitability of death unless the Lord comes first. Now we are not, but up for in general, apart from that, then that is the despair of mankind. Then looking at the woman and the man individually, it describes how God's displeasure with them, how the curse will affect them in terms of their distinctive cultural, societal functioning, the woman with her childbearing, the man with his labor in the field. The woman will be bearing children. That's the common grace aspect of it. Huh? In spite of the fall, there still will be children. But with miscarriage, with barrenness, with the labor of childbearing, with abortions, with all of the unhappy miseries that can attend the process. And as for the man and his distinctive role of exercising dominion over the world and so on, his farming will bring forth fruit, and there will be bread on the table. There will be wine to make glad the heart of man. There will be achievements of various kinds, but along with the successful crops, there will be a lot of thorns and thistles plaguing his efforts, and there will be drought, and there will be terrible famines, and so on. That's the common curse. As I say, both things are there. The curse balanced by the blessing that at other times there will be feasting and plenty according to God's sovereign pleasure. God's grace is always sovereign. And the measure in which he's going to bestow that grace, which will offset the common curse, is a matter of his sovereign pleasure. And as a matter of fact, the common blessings may be poured out more abundantly on the seed of the serpent than they are on the seed of the woman. It's according to his sovereign pleasure, and you can't dispute with that. We don't deserve, no one has a right in our fallenness to any of the blessings, and it's not something for us to dispute with God about. But here, then, what we're emphasizing is that things are going to be different. God's smile is not there as it was in the Garden of Eden at the beginning. His hands are not just raising benediction over his people. There's a wrath on God's countenance now. There is a change in space and time between God's original attitude of favor and his attitude of displeasure, which he now announces in this word of the common curse. And even though, as we were just intimating, Eve is elect in Christ, and Adam too, nevertheless here they are looked at not as individuals elect in Christ, but they are looked at here in terms of Adam's having represented all of mankind. And so here's a word that God expresses to the generality of mankind, without distinction between election and reprobation. Here is how what will be the experience of the generality of mankind, and God has to speak that here. And likewise, the next step in the process is the expulsion from the garden. They are elect in Christ. As a matter of fact, as we'll see, they go out of the garden wearing robes which are emblematic of the righteousness of Christ, but nevertheless they have to leave the garden at this particular point. God has to register in history at this point in space and time this discontinuity that has taken place. There is a change from the original, the normal, to the abnormal. Things are not normal now. And there has been that change that took place at this particular point. See, evil has not always been there. This curse has not always been there. This is a result of man's own culpability and responsibility, his fallenness. So they have to be expelled from the garden. They have forfeited their right of guarding the garden, and the cherubim are now placed there to take over that task in their place. You know, it's like the Israelites. They were supposed to go in and conquer the land, and they were afraid, didn't want to do it. And as soon as God tells them, now you can't do it anymore, now they want to rush back into the land which they have forfeited, and God won't let them in. Now they want to rush back in, and of course they're defeated. Well, now this is the propensity of mankind. Now that he's forfeited the Garden of Eden, it will be his desire to go rushing back in there and grab the Tree of Life for himself, even though he doesn't belong there. God knows that's what's in his heart, and so God keeps him out. God sets up the flaming sword. The only way back to the Tree of Life is through the sword, through the flaming sword. And that's why Jesus, as the representative of his people, has to undergo the flaming sword. In order to come to the Tree of Life himself and to get the fruit of the Tree of Life for us, he has to pass through the flaming sword. The seed of the woman has to suffer the crushing of the bruising of his heel in order that there might be salvation for his people. He has to experience the judgment of God exercised through his agents, the cherubim. Jesus has to experience that sort of death in order to make his way back into the presence of God, the Tree of Life, which he does, and then for us. Well, that then brings us to the that next section, which is the covenant of redemption. And we'll be looking at some of these same passages just quickly to pick up on the more positive side of them. We've just looked at them from point of view of what they say about the way in which they end the history of the covenant of creation and bring God's judgment upon the fallenness that is there. But on page 86 and following, I'll have an introductory section, all right? Under the heading Redemptive Covenant in the Old World. I have a section where I have material that we probably covered in our overview of the covenants. What I'm trying to bring out here is that business of how there was the covenant in eternity between the Father and the Son, covenant of works between the Father and the Son as a second Adam. And it's in terms of that eternal covenant then that Christ comes into the world in his incarnation and fulfills the commitments he made up there. And on the basis of his having fulfilled them, he is now authorized to administer the covenant of grace. And had that discussion earlier on these pages. I just try to give some of the biblical evidence for construing the earthly mission of Christ in terms of a fulfilling of that eternal pact with the Father. So I think we needn't then go through that in detail. Please read it. And then on page 89, I have the heading, the inauguration now of redemptive covenant. And I begin with three features of this new stage, which were not part of the covenant of creation. And what I do here is to make some further use then of the Genesis 3:15 text to emphasize the positive messianic aspects of it rather than just the curse on Satan, to bring out the points of redemption and Messiah and so on. And I specify then three features, the features of Messiah, grace, and election as being new features now characteristic of the covenant of redemption. Under the covenant with Adam at the beginning, there was no thought of Messiah or Christ. If Adam had passed his probation, there would have been no need for a second Adam. And so you wouldn't have had a messianic theme. And in terms of the covenant of creation itself, there was no provision for a Messiah. Yes, God, we know, had this in view and introduces it very quickly after the fall, but nevertheless, simply in terms of the provisions that he specifies right from the beginning, the contents of the covenant of creation, there's this no Messiah theme there. There'd be, as I say, no need for an incarnation of Christ if the first Adam had done what he was supposed to have done. So the Messiah theme is a new one that you see got announced right away in Genesis 3:15. Now, if history is going to go on to that heavenly goal, the Messiah is certainly very much needed. And so that's a new theme. What's also needed now is the feature of grace. So Christ, grace. All right, now here's that whole subject once again of works and grace. As we said, apart from the fall, it would have been a simple matter of works. Not the 1 gram of grace would have been needed in order then, had Adam passed his probation, for him to be confirmed in righteousness, to receive the word of approbation, and to move on ultimately to glorification and the heavenly glory, he would have earned it. Works. Do this and you will live. Now, that would have been the deal. No grace there. Grace is the distinctive thing of redemption. Grace is where God is going to bestow those blessings even though they have been demerited, even though they have been forfeited. That's what grace means. Where God blesses you even though you have forfeited those blessings. And so that is a new feature, but that's the glory of the gospel. That is a feature now. Christ comes as the one who has the offer of grace. Yes, Christ is able to do that because he has fulfilled the eternal covenant of works. It is not without the obedience of the one that the many are made righteous. It's only in terms of that obedience, it's only as Christ fulfills the works that there can be grace. But now there is indeed grace for us. And then thirdly, this whole thing works itself out as indeed the eternal covenant had in view, that Christ is the representative not of everybody. Adam was the representative of everybody. Whatever Adam did would be imputed to all. What Christ does, both in terms of his passive and active obedience, is imputed to those who are in view in the mutual commitments of the Father to the Son. The Son undertakes to live and to die for the elect. The Father commits himself to give those elect to Christ. But now you do get that thought of the election. And Genesis 3:15 already had that, the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent. There is that division within humankind between a people of God and the others, between the Jacobs and the Esau's. And so here are three distinct features now of this new redemptive order. The inauguration now, that was the general heading here, the inauguration of this covenant is announced in Genesis 3:15. We've already seen it, all right? Enmity I will put between you and the woman. That's the announcement of the new covenant of grace. God is going to do a work of restoration, restoring Eve, now back to fellowship with her in a covenant of peace and life, of course, through her messianic seed. So the new covenant was inaugurated by way of declaration, if you will, in Genesis 3:15. Then in Genesis 3:16 through 19, now that was the word of this common curse, which, however, implied the common grace of God, the common blessing of God. Now, doesn't the fact that God introduces an order that provides for history to go on, isn't that already a big intimation that he has something? You know, if he didn't have salvation in mind, and as soon as man fell, then the heavens could pass away and man could be cast into outer darkness pronto. All right, then that would be the end of it all. But it isn't. God doesn't deal with them in terms of the threat of that original covenant. He introduces something whereby history is going to go on in not as happy a way as it had been, but in some tolerable form of existence. And in the light of Genesis 3:15, with some great prospects of restoration in view. So the very fact then that the Lord announces this common, not final curse, the very fact that he provides for a historical development to move on. It is another indication then of his purposes of grace. And then finally, Genesis, we're going right through these verses, 15, 16 through 19, and then 20 and 21 is where we have a seal, not just a declaration of God's purposes and so on, but a symbolic transaction whereby God seals the promises which he has just made. And here again, I would refer you for the exegetical details to page 93-95, but essentially you remember what's going on. Adam has heard the gospel in Genesis 3:15, and he has heard that Mother Eve is going to be standing there, is going to be the center of a development. There's going to be the offspring of the woman who are like unto her. And so he has heard a promise that relates her to the origins of this redemptive history, and he's believed it. Adam has heard this word with faith, and so he proceeds now in the light of what God has said to name his wife. And so he says he named her life. So here she was associated with this prophecy of restoration of life, and Adam says, "Amen, Lord, great. I believe it, and in the light of that, I name this woman life, Hava, because she would become the mother of all the living." So that Adam has given his expression of faith here, and God therefore now can move from the words of the common curse to a symbolic expression of his special saving grace. And it all takes the form then of this covering that God provides for their nakedness. So there's all the rich symbolism of the nakedness that Adam had pointed to, the shameful nakedness as the alleged excuse for his fleeing from the presence of God. And God, of course, pushes him to the wall and says, "Well, the real reason, of course, was that you disobeyed me." But nevertheless, now since Adam has alleged that this sense of shameful nakedness was the cause of the problem, well, God will take it at that point and now proceed to express his intention to correct things by saying that, "Well, I'll provide a covering for that nakedness." So the whole episode can be conceived of in terms of the theme of a divorce, a double divorce. That has taken two covenants have existed. There's been the vertical covenant between God and mankind, and that marriage relationship has been broken. There's been the great divorce, and the man and the woman, mankind, giving their marital allegiance, or they're making their covenant with Satan. So there's been a divorce between man and God. And then at the horizontal level, there was the covenant of marriage between the man and the woman. And they have divorced one another in the whole process of the fall. They have reputed marriage as an authority structure, as we've seen. And in the course of the interrogation, you know, they have repudiated one another. "That woman whom you gave me," he refers to her, "not my wife," or anything like that. So there's been a divorce at that level. Now what the Lord proceeds to do, insofar as nakedness is expressive of, and by the way, in ancient legal practice where there was divorce and the reprehensible guilty party in the affair would be thrust forth naked as a sort of symbolic legal sign of the disruption of the marriage, and so providing a covering for nakedness fits in with procedures with respect to the setting forth of the reality of a divorce. So that's one way then in which this covering that God provides can be understood as a covering for nakedness. Now, quite apart from a divorce taking place and nakedness entering into the picture, covering with a garment is also then an ancient practice as attested elsewhere in the scripture. Think of Ruth and Boaz, for example. The covering with the garment or taking hold of the hem of the garment, that kind of symbolism is expressive of coming under the authority as a marital authority of someone. And so God's putting a covering over them would, in those terms, be symbolic of you know, like Boaz and Ruth, of the Lord's covering them over with the garment of his authority, so he is once again husband and they are wife. And likewise at the horizontal level, and incidentally, the skin that he takes for this purpose is a singular. It's a skin, and which is appropriate to express, I think, the unity, even if he makes the separate garments out of this one new skin, he covers the two of them. So I think that the symbolism is very rich here, and this covering that God provides is expressive of remarriage, recovenanting, both vertically between himself and man, and the man and the woman. See, the man has assumed his proper responsibility by naming the woman, which is an expression of his authority over there, which honors God's original authority structure, and the man being ready to do things properly. Now God symbolizes the restoration of their marriage. But of course, most significantly, what he's doing is prophesying of how there is enmity with Satan and there is fellowship again with himself. Now, the text doesn't speak about the death of an animal to provide this covering. It only speaks about the remedial results. God provides a remedy. This isn't the real atonement, clearly. It's only a symbolic expression that God is going to provide a covering and an atonement. But nevertheless, you and I and any other reader of the passage can't read this thing without really some animal had to die to provide this skin. And so our minds are directed to that right away. And therefore, certainly, here is the beginning in Scripture of that theme of the shedding of blood to make a covering atonement. Here is a further exposition of the theme that the messianic seed of the woman must suffer in order to win the victory over Satan, to provide the garment of righteousness, or if you will, one of the important components of the image of God. See, man must be restored as the image of God, second component of the image of God, this moral excellence, this righteousness, and so on, this state of righteousness. So that's what's going on in this wonderful symbolism in Genesis 3:21. So thus the covenant of redemption is inaugurated by declaration and by the intimations of here and by God's own symbolic ritual. Maybe what would be useful right at this point is to give you a quick now overview. Another chart, we just had a chart of the covenant of creation, sort of summing up everything that we had done. Maybe now we can have a chart of the covenant of redemption, anticipating where it's going from this point on, and then we can go back and work our way through it. We can find our little chart. We might have put something like this on when we gave our overview. I've forgotten whether we did or not. Well, let's see. There's that eternal covenant again, back of it all. The covenant of the Father and the Son in eternity. All right? So back of it all, we have that arrangement. In fulfillment of it, we have the incarnation, where the Son fulfills his commitment to take upon himself the form of man, experience the death of the cross, and so on. So Christ, as the second Adam, now has his covenant of works to fulfill in obedience to it. He enters into the world, so we have the incarnation. And, of course, he comes as a second Adam. And so his task is to do what the first Adam failed to do. He must undergo probation. A probation that will involve suffering. It's going to come in the form of the covenant servant. The eternal Son now takes upon himself the form of the the servant, the second Adam, and he undergoes that probation. He fights the battle of Armageddon, Satan again approaching where he doesn't belong, and so forth, and he wins the decisive victory, repudiating Satan, get thee behind me, and so on. And as a result of which, Revelation 12, Satan is cast out of heaven, and so on.